everyone, and welcome to episode 120 of season 11 of Movie Our Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season is a good friend, Nick Rehack of Rabbit Hole Podcast. Welcome back once again, Nick.
Thank you so much for having me back, Rob. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I always love having you on. I always love talking to you, whether it's, you know, on Zoom or in person. It's always fun to talk to Nick Rehack.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Even if it's not about music, you know. All right, so let's start with my initial question that I ask everybody. What is your background with Band of Brothers?
I watched Band of Brothers when it came out initially. My uncle and aunt and grandfather, I have a lot of family members and extended family members that have served in the military. So when the show came out, it was kind of big for them because two of them had served in World War II, and others, like my uncle, was just a big World War II guy, like just, you know, really into it. Loved the show, loved World War II movies that have come out, you know, all kinds of things like that. And when the show came out, I remember watching on HBO, and I remember at the time, because I was rather young, HBO kind of being like a big deal to me and being like, oh, wow, here's this whole, you know, TV channel that has all this stuff. And like, we didn't have it, but my uncle had it. So it was like kind of a big deal to go over and watch the shows at his house. And I'm like, man, maybe I'm a little too young for this, or maybe not, so on and so forth. And it's one of those shows where every so often I just kind of get the bug and I'll rewatch it again. I might not watch every single episode all the way through. I might watch like the first three and then skip over to seven, or just, you know, this time around, I'm just going to watch three and four. I might piecemeal it. So it was kind of nice to revisit it again and watch all of it just kind of in preparation. And then obviously the episodes that we're going to be talking, or the segments, excuse me, that we're going to be talking about. And then it's also interesting in history classes when it came time to discuss moments in World War II and the Holocaust. There were times where they would pull clips from this show.
Oh, wow.
And they would show images and be like, you know, this is, you know, obviously this isn't, you know, real footage, but it's a simulation and very close to what it would have been like. And so they would show clips of this, and then we'd have discussions about it as well as our textbooks and things like that. So Band of Brothers has kind of always been there, creeping up every so often in the background.
Wow. Wow. Very good. I'm very happy to hear that, you know, I have another guest who has enjoyed watching it over and over and over. Have you ever watched all 10 parts, you know, straight?
Never straight through. It's always taken me, this time around, it took me like a month to kind of get through it all, just because of having a newborn. It's tough to sit down and binge watch something anymore. But usually I would do it like I'd watch one or two episodes one day, then one or two the next day, so on and so forth, but never sat down and just powered through.
Right.
I think that would be a lot to do emotionally, because I forgot how emotionally charged this series can be, and some moments that even surprised me at how emotional I got, and I'm just like, wow, like this is, you know. And I think with everything kind of going on in the world and looking at war and discussing war and being like, man, this really, like, how have we not learned our lessons, you know? Like, how are we allowing ourselves to kind of repeat history on certain things? And it's just interesting how something that was made, you know, 25 some odd years ago is still impactful. It still carries the same messages. Nothing's lost. Nothing feels dated about it. And it's also kind of from a fun aspect being like, oh my gosh, I forgot that this actor was in here, or oh no way, like I forgot this person was in here. So that part of it is always like a nice little game to play when you're not feeling overwhelmed by the emotion of it all.
Right. I think someone should make a game of like name the unfamous actor bingo or something like that. You know, you can watch him go, hey, there's James McAvoy. Hey, there's Simon Pegg. Oh, hey, there's you know, Michael Fassbender.
Oh, there goes Tom Hardy.
There you go. Exactly. There goes a very, very small, thin, and sometimes naked Tom Hardy. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent. So Episode 120 begins with Liebgard being quite distraught and ends with the men beginning to pack up. So we basically left things off yesterday with actually a pretty sad place where, you know, the men started to have to, you know, let the all these prisoners know that they can't be moving around anymore. They have to, you know, herd them back in, and that's you know, not something that any of them really want to do. And you know, we have Liebgard, who is being portrayed as a Jew, even though he isn't, or he wasn't, you know, having to basically tell everyone, you know, to go back, and you know, go back into the camp, because they don't want them to overeat, and you know, get sick after they've now been rescued or you know, released. I'm trying to think of what the best word would be. They've been what word would you use about, you know, the of getting these people out of this camp? They've been, I can't think of the word.
They've been freed, but in order to, like, I guess, transition out, they have to kind of do it in stages. Yeah. Like has to be taken easy, step by step.
Right. They've been repatriated. That's the word I keep thinking. I'm trying to think of. Yeah. And you know, now we begin this this segment with Liebgard, who's played by Ross McCall, who hopefully in a few days everyone will be able to hear my interview with him, and you know, we'll get some more insight of what he thinks about these things, about filming this type of this scene, you know. And you know, did he know at the time that Liebgard was not a Jew, you know, even though he was told that he needs to portray himself as one? So you know, we'll find out on we'll find out next Tuesday when I speak to him. You know, we'll hear what he has to say about that. I'm really looking forward to talking to him about that. And he basically has to let all of these people know that you know, they have to go back in. So he's talking to them in you know, in German, and you can see the emotion on his face. And we have a whole bunch of soldiers around there just trying to herd these men back into the you know, back into the camp itself. And you can see that you know, these prisoners are completely confused as to what's really going on. You know, they've now been repatriated, but they don't know what to do. And then Liebgard himself, you can see that he basically has an emotional breakdown here. And he just sits down in the truck as, you know, all the men are the other men are herding, you know, these prisoners back into the camp, and he just starts crying and breaks out. You know, again, a great portrayal by Ross McCall here, that you can see how emotional his character is meant to take this type of thing. So I like the way that they do that.
Yeah, and it's got to be draining too. Just so much emotion and so much adrenaline from everything. It's the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And it's not just like you're talking to one or two people. It's not like he's having a discussion with like a small group that they found in a basement or something like that. Like, it's an entire encampment of people that have, you know, have been having the experiences that they're having. And it's, how do you see so much joy and then have to take that away from them inadvertently, even though like it is for the betterment overall, sure, but in that moment it doesn't feel that way.
Right. Not at all. So yeah, that's a great way that they portray this. And then we're back and we see the town, and you know, we see the soldiers walking around the town, and then we're inside of, I guess, the commandeered office that Winters is going to be taking over for this time, for the time being. And then Nixon comes in and says, he's looking around at all the, he's trying to find something to drink here. And he goes, turns out I'm staying in the only dry friggin' house in Germany. And I mean, we all know that Nixon is he likes to drink, but even though he is a functional drunk, which is also good in this type of situation. And and Winters is a little surprised at the fact that that he's actually willing to, I guess, stoop to drinking something not Vat 69.
Yeah. I think in this case it's any port in a storm.
Yeah, seems that way because you know, I mean, we did have the episode, we had the incident last week, you know, where he just shatters the window of the pharmacy just to hoping that there's maybe some booze there.
Yeah.
So, you know, he has his way of coping. You know, Ron Livingston does a great job here.
It's so great because I can remember my first introduction to him was Office Space, and then to all of a sudden see this movie, I'm like, hold on a second. Like, again, like a young, you know, movie and TV watcher, I'm like, oh, like he, you know, these actors can play different types of characters, different types of people. And it makes me, every time I see Ron Livingston, I'm always like, man, I forget how good an actor he is, and I got to go out and watch more stuff that he's in. Every single time I'm reminded of that, and then I just don't. Until I see him pop up in something, I'm like, man, I got to watch more stuff with Ron Livingston in it. Because he's just good. And it's so effortless with him. It never feels like acting. It immediately feels like you know this character and you know this guy. Even as there's more, you know, revelations about his character as the show progresses, the decisions they make, like everything just is effortless with him.
Yeah. And I mean, I've seen many movies and TV shows that Ron Livingston has been in, and in my opinion, he's the best here. But you know, some people think it's Office Space. I like him there, but I like him better here. You know, that, yeah, I can relate. 100%. I can relate to his character here, even though you know he's going through a very emotional time anyway. You know, especially when he just found out that she's taking the dog. You know, he doesn't care if they're taking the kid, but they're taking the dog. Oh my God. She's crossed the line.
Yeah.
Right. So where do you think he mentions, you know, that he's staying in the only dry friggin' house in Germany. Where do you think the term dry comes from when relating to sobriety, relating to booze, things like that? What would you think?
Well, I know dry just means it's not there. I've been to dry weddings. I've driven through dry counties in the South, so I'm aware of it. But I'm unsure of its origins.
Okay, so it goes all the way back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, and it was basically considered political slang. And
interesting.
The idea was that it had a lot to do with prohibition. You know, because before prohibition started in 1920, there was a lot of debate about prohibition, about drinking and stuff like that. And the nicknames for the people on the various sides of the political spectrum were the dries were people who supported banning or restricting alcohol, and the wets were the ones who were against having to try and stop the they were against having a ban, you know, that type of thing.
Huh. See, I thought it would have happened sooner than from Prohibition era. Like, I assumed it would have been, I don't know from what cause, but I would assume, like, maybe back in, like, the 15 or the 1600s even being like, you know, this is a dry town and, you know, you can't do this and that because of the other thing. And then it just kind of carried over as the years gone by.
Right. No. That, you know, that, I mean, that maybe they, I'm assuming they referred to something else, but, you know, according to the research I did, a dry only came out at that time. And as you mentioned, after the repeal of prohibition, there were still counties, states, regions that decided to ban the sale or consumption of alcohol, and they became known as dry counties.
Yeah.
And I mean, it makes sense that you would call it dry.
there's no booze to be had, you know. And I also feel like that's kind of the nicest and kindest way to say it, because anything else might come across as like too technical or too overbearing. Whereas you go, oh, it's dry. Oh, okay. And it's real nonchalant. And I mean, I don't like the concept of it, but like I prefer like the nicer way to say, yeah, there's no fun here.
Right. So, I mean, it's also very interesting, the whole idea about, you know, that there still are these days areas in the U.S. that are that are dry. First of all, you have 34 states that allow the local municipalities to make that decision.
And whoa, it's that many?
Yeah. And there are roughly 300 strictly dry counties around the entire country.
What?
And most of them are obviously concentrated in the Bible Belt region, in the American South, the lower Midwest, and things like that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Now, what's very interesting is there are also two states that the law there dictates that all counties have to be dry by default, unless the local community specifically changes that.
Huh.
You know, again, they're not forcing it, but the, you know, in these two states, can you have any idea what states it would be? You have any guess?
One of them, I think, is Arkansas.
No.
Okay. That would have been Arkansas would have been my guess, and then maybe Oklahoma second. But I would have really leaned in on Arkansas.
Nope. The other two are Kansas and Tennessee. And
Tennessee.
In those states, in Kansas, there are still three counties that are fully dry, and in Tennessee, there are five that are fully dry.
So they know Jack Daniel's made in Tennessee, right? There's a whole subgenre called Tennessee whiskey. They know that, right?
Yeah, I'm assuming, but they only have five counties that are still dry.
That's incredible.
Right. But what you're talking about in Arkansas, so Arkansas has the highest concentration of the most dry jurisdictions. 45% of the counties prohibit sales of alcohol.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. Kentucky has 15 fully dry counties, which is only 11% of the counties. Mississippi used to have a statewide prohibition until 1966, but there are still 12 counties that remain dry. Texas has five fully dry counties.
Are you sure that's not just from the weather? Because it is rather hot down in Texas.
Drinking is not going to cool you off, is it? It's going to make you forget that it's hot. That it might.
I feel like it's kind of the same thing, though.
Maybe. So there's also a term called the moist counties, meaning that alcohol sales are highly specific, meaning that they can ban liquor stores but allow restaurants to sell beer and wine, you know, things like that. But it could also be that the county itself is dry, but there are certain cities within the county that it turned into a wet wet city. Stuff like that, which an example of that is the city of Conway, which is in Arkansas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. I've never heard of a moist county or a moist city like that. That's interesting.
And now you know where to go when you're looking for it.
Yeah, if I'm ever in Arkansas.
Right. There's also places that have what's known as They're dry counties, but restaurants are able to circumvent the law by having what's known as a private club loophole, which requires patrons to purchase a nominal membership before ordering a cocktail. Meaning, if it's a private club, you're allowed to do it.
So like like a dinner club, or like if you belong to like a Moose or something like that.
I guess so, yeah.
Maybe not a Moose, maybe like an Eagles or something like that. For fraternal order of Eagles, or what do they have in the Flintstones? The Loyal Order of the Water Buffalo?
Something like that, yeah. Which makes sense. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I get it.
I do too. You can understand that.
Kind of like how here in Baltimore, specifically like in the counties, you can buy liquor Monday to Saturday, but most liquor stores are closed on Sunday. They're allowed 2 Sundays a year to be open. Most of them pick Super Bowl Sunday, and I think like other random Sundays throughout the year. But a lot of them can circumvent that by doing like they sell packaged goods kind of thing. So like, oh, it is beer, but it's technically not because it's attached to a restaurant which does like a to-go type thing. Like it, there's ways to circumvent it and get around it, sure. And I think it's always going to get that way. But I think the club one sounds a little more interesting because at least with that one, if you're going around it, you're being social. There's other people around. You get to see a friendly face. You're not just like kind of, just hanging out around the house or going to a store where it might be more transactional and not as friendly.
Okay,
You
but
know?
if you're in the bar, it's going to be friendly also, isn't it? It's going to
That's true.
be that's also going to be social. So,
That is true. That is true.
yeah, makes sense. So Nixon then starts looking through the bottles that are in this particular place, and Winter says, "I thought you weren't drinking the local." He goes, "Yeah, well, basically, well, this is what I got." So,
Yeah.
I know how to make do with what I need to, that type of thing. I just like the way that they do that. He's basically just shrugging his shoulders. Yeah, well, what can they? And he just starts taking a swig out of the bottle. I mean, it looks like it's vodka or something, but I'm not sure what he's drinking.
I assumed because it's clear like that it was so I guess vodka's his choice, even though I'm fairly certain it wasn't the vat like a Scotch. The vat was a Scotch
I
whiskey,
believe
right?
so. Yeah, you're more of a whiskey person than I am, so you would have a more of an idea of that one. But I do believe that that's what it is. And then Winters continues and says, "Well, I heard from Division. They've been finding camps like this all over the place. Jesus, seems the Russians liberated one a lot worse. Worse? Yeah, apparently, 10 times as big. Execution chambers." Ovens. Oh, for cremating all the bodies. You could see that Nixon is completely in shock about this whole thing. He goes, "Jesus. Locals claim they never even knew the camp existed. They say we're exaggerating." Huh. "Well, you're gonna have a hell of an education tomorrow. General Taylor declared martial law about an hour ago. Ordered every able-bodied German in town, aged 14 to 80, to start burying the bodies. They'll begin in the morning." He goes, "10th Armor are going to supervise cleanup." So again, this is, they do a great job of giving us this information. Anyone who knows a little bit about the history of everything that's going on, right now we're in April of 45. So even back, all the way back in January, there were places that were being liberated on the Eastern Front. So you'd think that Winters would have known about this before. They're making it seem as if this is a complete shock to everybody that, oh, we never would have thought that something like this could have happened or anything like that. This is the first we're hearing of it, but it's a little strange. But I think that's being done, for the viewers, for people to get a better grasp of what is happening. My assumption is that they had more of a clue beforehand.
Probably, and I think if you do this show today, they would have named names. They would have said the names of places. Oh yeah, they just liberated this place called blah blah blah. And this way the viewer goes, oh, I know that, or the viewer who's probably sitting there watching the show with their phone open would immediately Google it and then figure out and then look at, the images of or learn a little bit about it as the characters are talking. Whereas this, and I find throughout the show, the way the information is just disseminated like that, sometimes it feels almost too casual. It feels almost too kind of like off the cuff, and it's sometimes like wild to me. But then at the same time, these characters, if they're also just finding out, much like the audience, like, oh, we had no idea this was going on, there's this overwhelming shock. Because what do you do with that information? These characters aren't really aware that someone would do something like this, right? No one really ever thinks of something like this
No.
happening. because it's not really staring them in the face, and it's not something that's talked about a lot. And it's still just even to think about it now, it's like you don't really get the gravity of the situation. You don't really grasp the heft and just size and operation of everything. And it's just it's staggering. It's truly staggering. And even to talk about it in classrooms, I can remember talking about it in classrooms in history and stuff and just not fully grasping it. Yeah, we can understand what happened, but not we'll never really grasp it unless like we went there. I don't want to say on a field trip, but like as part of a class trip to be like, well, here's, you know, here's the place and here's where, and then to see it and touch it and make it tactile all of a sudden. I think that's what they're trying to do. And they do a great job of like kind of just having that just shock and being overwhelmed. A lot of these actors throughout the whole series, just the shock and overwhelmingness of everything and just kind of going numb almost and retreating. Whereas I think, again, if it was made today, the characters would have these big emotional moments, and here comes the score that swells in, or there's something like really, really pushing the emotion and drama. And this, it's just a couple sentences, and we just get reactions, right. And it's just it's, you know what I mean? It's gobsmacking.
Yeah, for sure. So the book describes it has three and a half paragraphs that talks about everything that we're going to be talking about today and tomorrow. But so I'll read part of it now, and we'll move along as it as we watch the stuff also. But so it starts on page 217 of the book and says, on April 29th, the company stopped for the night at Buchlau in the foothills of the Alps near Landsberg. Here they saw their first concentration camp. It was a work camp, not an extermination camp, one of the half dozen or more that were part of the Dachau complex. But although it was relatively small and designed to produce war goods, it was so horrible that it was impossible to fathom the enormity of the evil. Prisoners in their striped pajamas, three-quarters starved by the thousands, corpses little more than skeletons by the hundreds. So again, they're giving us they're giving us detail of the whole thing. But and I'll point out once again that I love the way that the writers were able to take a paragraph like that and give us something so much more to visually look at.
Yeah.
Even I mean the book yeah. obviously gives us. It's very descriptive of all these things, which is great. But seeing it and watching the way that they do it is amazing also.
It gives it life, and it's these characters that interact with it, and it's kind of our vessel, if you will, of interacting with it. And it breathes life into it, and it becomes, because I think people inherently are just better visual learners.
Right.
So to be able to see it and put it into like perspective.
That's true. And then Nixon says to Winters, well, what about us? And he goes, well, we head out for, he looks on the piece of paper and he goes, Thalheim tomorrow. You know, he has a little trouble pronouncing it, which I like that added gesture, you know, that obviously, you know, an American officer from Pennsylvania is not going to be able to pronounce the German words so simply.
Yeah, it's a nice touch. It's a humanizing touch, and it reminds you, because you know, watching the show, you're like, oh yeah, it's this person. No, this was a real person. This was a real human being that went through all of this. When I was living in New Orleans, we went to the World War II Museum, and there was many different sections where you could stop and push a button, and someone would read aloud like a journal entry or an interview segment from a person. And one of the people was Winters. And every time he'd go through, you could push a button. And I don't think it was his voice exactly. It might have even been why can't I think of his name? Damian okay. Lewis. It might even have been his voice reading the segment there. But to be able to read it and be like, oh wow, like these were just actual people doing this stuff. And then funny enough too, like when I go up to Hershey Park, we go over this small bridge and it's named after him. It's the Richard D. Winters Bridge, and every time I drive over, I'm just like, yeah, real people experience this, something that, you know, no human being should have to experience. And to humanize it and kind of have that little thing, because it's not like they're poking fun at him being like, I don't know how to pronounce words. It's no, he's a very intelligent military person, but obviously he's not going to know how to pronounce, you know, German or Austrian, Swiss, you know, all these different things correctly. So it might take him a moment or two. And I think that's a really, like you said, a really great, like kind of trait, a little thing mm-hmm. to put in
there. Yeah. Now, you see, you just reminded me of something as you were telling your story there, that so you know, as anyone who's been listening to me and Nick talk, on any of the seasons over the last few years, we always talk about the fact that he and I met in person 4 years ago. So after I left your house 4 years ago, I drove very close. I drove by where Winters lived, which is like so cool that we're, just it just hit me right now, that's the way that's the path that it took me on.
It's almost like it was meant
Yeah,
to be.
certainly. Who
It's
knew that?
the universe being like, hey, don't
That's
forget.
right. Who knew that 4 years later, we'd be talking about it, and I'd be like, hey, I remember that. I drove past Winters's town after my great afternoon with Nick.
It was a
I
great
know it was.
afternoon.
I know, especially when I was sneezing from your cat.
The same cat who's actually sitting, well, actually he's sleeping next to me right now.
Maybe that's why I feel like I need to keep sneezing. I don't know. Very possible. It's possible. And Winters then basically ends the whole thing by saying 1,200 hours. So by noon they're getting ready to go the following day. But there's still a lot more for us to have to take in here before seeing that. And I mean, Nixon is in complete shock about this whole thing also. He just shakes his head in complete disbelief as to everything that's going on here. Now, these guys did not expect this. Even if they knew about, concentration camps, stuff like that. I mean, you can even go back to the movie Casablanca or a lot of movies at the in the early 40s that were talking about, the fascists of the Germans and that people were sent to concentration camps and stuff like that. The term was being used, but nobody had any clue as to what really was going on in those places, and that these were extermination camps, that type of thing.
And I think a lot of it because we use the phrase concentration camp, and it doesn't have the same intensity as extermination camp, which really that's what we should be using instead of concentration camp, just to remind ourselves and kind of like, hey, this was not just people are sitting here waiting. It's not a holding. There was a lot more going on. And I think sometimes we just don't get the severity of it because of how we word things, and it loses a little bit of its like heft and
Yeah,
intensity.
I definitely agree with that. And then the shot changes, and we see Nixon in a Jeep, smoking, going very fast through the countryside, going somewhere. We don't know where he's going. He looks like he's in a little bit of a daze, the way he's doing it. He's just letting the cigarette continue to burn out without him taking off the ash. And then we see that he's showing up in the daytime. This is apparently already the next day, and he's walking towards the camp, and one of the MPs salutes him and offers him a kerchief, and Nixon goes, "What?" And no thanks. And I like the detail then the background. You see a whole bunch of the locals show up. A man is carrying a shovel, and a woman is carrying her purse, or two women are carrying their purses, but they're all covering their noses, because of the smell of everything that's going on here. And then Nixon just walks through, and we see a bunch of nuns that have been, I guess, helping out with the cleanup also. And they once again show us a lot of the atrocities on the bodies that are being moved. And we see that locals basically are carrying these bodies and bringing them to, I guess, the collection point for them to go in and burn the bodies.
And they must not have been explained or told very well what exactly they'll be doing because they're not dressed for it. If you happen to look, most, if not all, of the women are in a dress of some sort, and their shoes, I'm fairly certain I saw like one or two of them are like in heels, not really like in boots or necessary. Like, they're just not dressed for what they're about to experience
Sorry,
and go
the
through.
men aren't either because they're all in suits. We see a bunch of men using shovels and stuff like that, and like one of them gives a dirty look to Nixon. It looks like he's possibly crying from what he has to do. But Nixon doesn't care. He's just, walking around, taking it all in as to what's going on. And you can see in the background, and I don't know if this is on purpose, because of Spielberg. Nixon is in the foreground, and the background you see a woman with a red jacket behind it.
I thought the same thing.
And then we,
I thought the same
that's
thing
right.
with that
And then
jacket.
we get a look at who it is. And it's the woman that Nixon was in her house just the other day. When he shattered the picture of her husband. And then left the then he left her house also at the same time. So it's interesting that we're revisiting and we see this older woman. I'm not gonna call her an elderly woman. Probably in her 60s. Trying
Probably.
to move one of the bodies or anything like that. And Nixon recognizes her and looks at her and he goes, "Hey, aren't you that little girl in Schindler's List with the
The
that's
little jacket.
And we see that she trips as she's trying to move thing. And then when she gains her balance again, she looks over and sees that it's Nixon who's there. And he has no sympathy for her whatsoever because he knows who she is. She's, the wife of one of these German German high-ranking commanders, and she then looks away and continues to try to do the work that she's supposed to do. But again, Nixon has no sympathy whatsoever for her. And then,
Do
yeah,
you,
go ahead.
I would say, do you think she knew what was going on, or do you think her husband kept this part of it away from her?
Well, again, this is not that far out of town, and the idea that people didn't know that this was going on—I mean, it's hard to believe, but it is possible, because again, we're looking at it from a 2026 perspective, where something that's
That
just a
is
few
true.
miles outside of your town, there's more of a chance you're going to know about it. Maybe they didn't. I'm not saying that to try and exonerate anybody, but the point is that it's just possible that no one gives thought to these type of things. I mean, I know that Sobibor was right outside of a town also, and everyone said, "Oh, well, we didn't know about that," but that one's harder to believe because that was an extermination camp where there was constantly smoke, so. Yeah, I don't know. And then the shot changes, and we see back what we saw at the very beginning of part nine. We see the six soldiers in a bombed out apartment a few floors up. So we get to see Percanti, we see Liebgott, we see Nixon, we see Luz, we see Bull, and we see Wester, and they're all just taking it in, looking at what's going on. And then Nixon says, "Hitler's dead." And then Liebknecht goes, "Holy shit." Nixon goes, "Yep, shot himself in Berlin." And Bull asks, is the war over yet?" And he goes, "Nope. We have orders to Berchtesgaden. We're going to move out in 1 hour." So, first of all, this is April 30th, 1945. That was the day that Hitler killed himself. And if you paid attention to what I said before, that the in the book it says that it was April 29th that they got there. So timing wise, they definitely got that one right. Webster has a great line at the very end here of this segment, and he goes, "Why? The man's not home." As we're going to talk about over next week, the Birch Garden was a home away from home for Hitler that he hated going to. Because he was afraid of heights. But we'll get there. I'm sure we'll talk about that when we get there. As I mentioned before, the book does talk a little bit about the whole thing. We talked about the huge wheels of cheese, and basically the rest of it says the company stayed in Buchloe for 2 nights. Thus, it was present in the morning when the people of Landsberg turned out, carrying rakes, brooms, shovels, and marched off the camp. General Taylor, it turned out, had been so incensed by the sight that he had declared martial law and ordered everyone from 14 to 80 years of age to be rounded up and sent to the camp to bury the bodies and clean up the place. That evening, the crew came back down the road from the camp. Some were still vomiting. The memory of starved, dazed men, Winters wrote, who dropped their eyes and heads when we looked at them through the chain link fence, in the same manner that a beaten, mistreated dog would cringe, leaves feelings that cannot be described and will never be forgotten. The impact of seeing these people behind the fence left me saying only to myself, now I know why I'm here. So again, that's a great line from Winters, you know, that unfortunately it took something like that to make him 100% understand that. But again, the name of part 9 is Why We Fight. So it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Then we see the men just start getting ready to leave. They've had enough, and then you know they give us a great shot of the people in the town, you know, dealing with cleaning up the the center of their town. this is the you know the Main Street Plaza or whatever it is. But you know it's a great way to show us you know how the Americans were looking at even the German people after they saw all these different things. You know, you get a completely different perspective on what they might have thought beforehand and what they're finally, you know, seeing here. And then Nixon claps Luz on the back as the men all start getting ready to leave. That is how this 5-minute segment ends. So, Nick, is there anything else that you wanted to add that you think I might have missed?
No, I wanted to touch on the woman's jacket, which you absolutely did, and it does harken back in my mind immediately to Schindler's List, because you have this like stark red jacket amongst everything that's so washed out and these muted tones and everything. And kind of like we talked about earlier, how you know they said, oh yeah, they're finding more camps, saying Hitler's dead, as if you just told somebody it's raining outside.
That's right.
There's not a lot of like pomp and circumstance. There's not a lot of thing to it. It's just, hey, here's this thing. And then there's not even really like celebration either. There's not like a yes, or there's not there's no triumph behind it. There's no excitement. They're just like, all right, next orders, on to the next thing. Like I find that just really interesting, because I can remember, and this is not really the same, but it's in the same vein, if you will. I can remember the night when, you know, Obama came out and was like, hey, we got bin Laden. And I can remember immediately people running into the streets, banging pots and pans and losing their minds over. And I'm not saying that that's what these guys should have done, but, you know, just this, it's just so matter of fact. It's like, okay, what's next? And I don't know. There's something about it. Then again, you're not going to go having a big celebration and hoopla when you're watching what you're watching, and that's, you know, a group of people cleaning up this camp. But I just that kind of thing just sticks out to me this time around, and I don't know why, but it's really just like the lack of energy behind hearing something like that is just, I don't know, I find it really, really interesting.
Yeah, and you know, just not long ago, I think it was maybe a week or two ago, we had them talking about the fact that that FDR died, and they said the president's dead, and it was the same type of intonation that Nixon gave when he's giving that information over, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
All right, so today's segment is called Band Brand, where my guests will give their top 5 movie bands. So I know you're a music guy, so I've been looking forward for a very long time to hear your choices for your top five movie bands. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
My number five is going to be the Lone Rangers from the movie Airheads. My number four is kind of a double. It's a combination of The Wonders / Cap'n Geech and the Shrimp Shack Shooters, because it's a fictional band playing another fictional band from the movie That Thing You Do. Fun Tom Hanks connection there. Number three is Death Clock from the Metalocalypse show and movies. Number two, he's a solo artist, but he does have a backing band with him. That's Dewey Cox from Walk Hard. And number one with the bullet, my absolute favorite, and it should come as a surprise to nobody that I would pick Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem.
No surprise from me on that one at all. Now, Dewey Cox is a movie that I had never seen, and a week and a half ago, Matthew was on, and he strongly recommended that I go watch it. I love that movie. It was such a
that
great movie.
It's so hilarious because it's so earnest in its satire of biopics. It's you can tell it's a love letter to biopics as well as like a send up of it as well. But it's so well done. It's so funny. I quote that movie nearly every day, every other day. I started quoting it at work. Nobody had heard of it, and then they watched the movie, and now they're quoting it with me at work. Like it's just such a good. Highly underrated movie, and anytime I get a chance to talk about Walk Hard, I talk about Walk Hard.
Yeah, I love listening to the lyrics of the songs, because they're it's a parody, but they say so much. And
it's like Weird Al level of parody, because Weird Al will do a direct parody, sure, like he might take Smells Like Teen Spirit and do Smell Like Nirvana, but he might also do like Weird Al does a song called eBay. But it's a song done in the style of like the Backstreet Boys, or it's a song done in the style of. So even in these films, like when Dewey Cox is doing a song in the style of, Bob Dylan, he's doing it in that style, but he's also like kind of satirizing it. But he's also got a message at the same time. Like it just works on so many different levels, and it's just great. Like it's just such a well done comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I totally agree with what Matthew told me, that you can only watch the director's cut. Don't watch the other cut.
Yes. I'm so glad. I'm so glad you said that. That brings me so much joy that you said that. I 1,000% agree.
Yeah. All right. And now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. So we're going to spin the wheel and see what movie Nick. This is a movie from 1983, okay. Right? And it stars, it's about British POWs in a Japanese camp, and basically they're trying to, I'll read the IMDb synopsis, it makes it a little easier. During World War II, a British colonel tries to bridge the cultural divides between a British POW and the Japanese camp commander, in order to avoid bloodshed. And the music connection here is the main actor is a musician who unfortunately is no longer with us, almost 10 years.
Okay, so the music connection gives it away.
Okay, well, that's why I gave it to you, because I heard.
I'm glad you did.
I heard the silence on the other end.
Here's the only problem. I know that it's David Bowie. I only know half of it. I know it's Merry Christmas and then somebody's name.
That's right.
But the name escapes me. It's Mr.
Lawrence.
Stewart. Lawrence. Okay, so Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I've been wanting to see that for a while now. That's been on my list solely because David Bowie's in the film.
Yeah. It's a pretty good movie. It's not amazing, but I like it. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so Nick, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Nick Rehack?
Absolutely. If you head over to rabbitholepodcasts.com, you can find me over on two shows, Lyrical Innuendo, myself and Bubba Wheat. We take a listen to a song. We examine the lyrics. We tell you if it's about sex, drugs, or just good old-fashioned rock and roll. And then there's another program I'm on called Play MST for Me, Jason Soto and myself. Jason is a massive Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan, and I've never seen a single episode of it. So we are going through and watching every single episode from the beginning. We are, I think, somewhere in the middle of season three. I've told him to not tell me how many seasons there are, how many episodes for a season. I'm going in as plain can be. So, but I'm having an absolute ball doing it. So head over to rabbitholepodcast.com or wherever you get your podcast and check out Lyrical Innuendo and Play MST for Me.
Okay, cool. Very good. I don't think I've ever seen any episodes of Mystery Science Theater either. So you're three seasons ahead of me on that one. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So everyone have a great weekend. Nick will be back with me on Monday for the final episode of Part 9. But until then, curry!
Hurry!